You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 o'clock on the west coast of the United States of America. Privileged to be joined once again, but the first time in a while, by Brigadier General Tom Drowdy, United States Marine Corps, retired. And Tom, first of all, good morning. How are you?
An honor and a pleasure.
First of all, part of your email address is Sage, okay? Is that a little bit of self-promotion, or is that a color?
No, the story in that was when I showed up to be the ADC of 1st Marine Division, the division staff said, you know, everybody's got a call sign. What's yours? And I said, I've never had a call sign. And then really taking a risk, I said to the staff, I'll tell you what, why don't you come up with what you think is an appropriate call sign? And so they got together and they came back and they said, we think you ought to be Sage.
What a bunch of kiss asses.
I said, is that because I'm the oldest guy here? And they said, no, because you give such good Sage advice to General Myatt. So with that, I became Sage.
Wow. Yeah, you're lucky there was nobody like me around there. We'd have come up with something a little bit more colorful.
I'm sure you would have, and I would have had a little bit.
I don't know how they get them now. Now it's mostly unit signs. Although the only personal one, I mean, for instance, the division's Blue Diamond, and so you know, the Blue Diamond actual, and if the CG's inbound or whatever. But General Mattis had a call sign. His call sign was Chaos. He tells the self-deprecating story that, he can stir it up and he can throw all 52 cards in the air if he's like most general officers can, if they show up and things aren't, you know, the way they expect them to be. But I think the acronym came from Colonel has another wait. The Colonel has an outstanding solution or something like that.
Okay.
And that's the way it came from. It was from his, whether battalion or regimental staff. He said it's not nearly as cool as one would think it. But Sage is pretty cool. I saw that and I was like, well, Tom is not given towards self-promotion. So I wonder where that comes from.
Yeah. So, and then 62 was the year that I became a Marine. The other one we had an opportunity was, for a collective call sign in Desert Storm for the division. and I thought about it and I said, you know, we're all kind of considered to be lions, so what do you call a group of lions? And the answer is pride.
Oh.
And so came the collective call sign for the division as we were a pride of lions, so to speak. So, but speaking of general officer's visits, one of the things you learn quickly is it's okay if the general shows up late, but it's never good if the general shows up early.
do generals know that? Because sometimes they're governed by larger forces that they don't rightly control. When you work with them, the only thing generals want to do is they want to go out and they want to know what they can do to help. And they can control assets. They can control emphasis to their staffs and the flow of assets. But if they don't know the truth, they can't do anything. And so Tom, talk about the general officer disdain for the dog and pony show and the PowerPoint presentation. They want to go see what's real, talk to Marines, see how they can help, how can I make it better. And it's just this constant trying to manage the unit that's putting on this dog and pony show, not to put on a dog and pony show. No, no, that's not what he wants, okay? I'm going to tell you right now, if you want to make him mad, you know, throw out the 80 slide PowerPoint and the dog and pony show.
Sure.
Tell me your thoughts on that.
Like so many things, Mac, the senior guy establishes the culture. And when the senior guy, in this case, the general, division commander, whatever the case may be, says and demonstrates, here's what I want and here's what I don't want, and then implements that immediately when someone says, well, he really didn't mean that, he doesn't want a PowerPoint, we're going to give him PowerPoint to let your feelings be known that this is not what I asked for. You know, and what I asked for is to get a chance to find out, and you stated it perfectly, how can I help? What's going on? Okay. What do I need to know? But then exactly what can I do to help? Because I have probably the main thing that the general officer has is power. He has authority. He can make things happen. He can make decisions. He can correct errors, all those things. But that will never happen unless people are truthful with him and candid with him. And sometimes that means telling the general bad news, telling the general things that he doesn't want to hear, but that he really needs to hear. And that's the business of speaking truth to power, which is so critical in any organization, be it military, government, business, the church, whatever the case may be. The leaders have to know the truth in order to do their jobs properly, in order to correct things, in order to help, in order to make the organization better.
You know what, Tom? I think it's one of the most important requirements of a subordinate. And you see it in young officers, young NCOs, staff NCOs. Will you look at your boss in the face and tell him the truth in spite of, you know that he's going to be pissed. But if when you see that in young leaders, I think most of us make a note like that guy, he's not afraid. He's not afraid to be a leader on the upside or the downside. And that's always impressive to me.
Yeah, George Marshall made his mark before World War One, or I guess it was actually in World War One, when General Pershing showed up and just ripped to pieces General Marshall's division commander. And so everybody's kind of silent. Okay, well, General Pershing is pretty upset about it. General Pershing, who I think was a lieutenant colonel at the time, stepped forward and said, General Pershing, you are wrong. Here's what has taken place. This is not as you have perceived it. This is what is going on. And the blame that you're assigned to the division commander is not correct. Here's the truth of what happened. And everybody, you know, stepping back for the blast that was coming. But Pershing and the others said, holy mackerel, we've got a smart, dedicated officer who speaks the truth to power. What a tremendous asset.
Let's put him in a desk job in Washington, D.C. and never let him see the sunlight. And we can all live in the world that he fashions, both as what was Marshall's title during World War II, Tom?
Oh, let's see. That's a great question. He was I guess principal advisor to the president. This is prior to the days of the Department of Defense.
Right.
It was
basically
the War Department. But one of his greatest contributions was his selection of people.
Right.
And so not only did he have great ideas, he had great instincts. And so he was the one who pulled Eisenhower as a lieutenant colonel, regimental XO, up to become what he was, because he saw in him what he needed for the Allied, coalition that was necessary in order to defeat Nazi Germany.
You know, and that's only part. That's only a part of his story. You know, Secretary Mattis is following in Secretary Marshall's footsteps. I mean, the law that had to be waived so that Secretary Mattis could assume the office of Secretary of Defense was George Marshall law, and then he goes on to become Secretary of State. And in this capacity, the Marshall Plan is not only a plan for the rebuilding of Europe, but it's also a plan, an economic plan for the United States for a soft landing after the robust military industrial expansion to provide not only armament for the United States, but to provide for Russia, to provide for our allies as well. Anybody who needed it, we were supplying tanks, ammunition, you know, and whatever they needed. That economy was going to contract, and they knew it. And so part of the post-war plan and the Marshall Plan for Europe was when we gave that aid, when we produced refrigerators, when we produced ovens, and we sent it all overseas. That was, you know, and so his contribution to the United States and the world that we live in today, George Marshall booms, you know, as Maximus says, what we do in life echoes in eternity. Well, Marshall doesn't echo, you know, he's a booming bass drum in our world that we live in today, and so interesting stuff.
Right, he was brilliant. Another part of that economy that we were facing was changing from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy, but suddenly we now have a workforce that is going to be composed of so many of those veterans who have returned. And so now what do they do for jobs? So it was tremendous challenges that existed. So Marshall, yeah, was absolutely brilliant. He is the author of a great quote that I use and I think about often when he said, "No democracy can survive a 7-year war."
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
I think about that one, and you count up the number of years we've been in, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. It just, you know, he understood the American people. He understood, of course, the military very well. And just a brilliance that I think is often overlooked. But, yeah, the Marshall Plan is one of the great successes and a real feather in the cap, so to speak, for the United States, and not just winning a war, but also ensuring that we're not going to have a war with our former enemies.
Well, I mean, also, really, what he did, and to me, what makes him so different, is he had an incredible grasp of what it would be to win the peace, and what it would do, what it would do for the free democracies of the world, and what America's role had to be in winning the peace. And I see, you know, it's interesting that we kind of just stumble into that, because to me, I see America at a crossroads in terms of, you know, of its leadership of Western, you know, of freedom and democracy around the world. And we're relearning a lesson is that the only way you can guarantee peace is through strength. You can't do it from a position of weakness, and I think our alliance in the Western Pacific is learning this again, that look, you know, we will hang together or we will surely hang separately, okay? And you know, what I mean by that is we will confront China as a group from South Korea to Japan, Taiwan, not sure about the Philippines anymore, Australia, and, you know, and maybe Vietnam. We will, and there's nothing the Chinese can do in the face of that, the free nations, and that kind of confrontation. China does not have the military power to confront that. And in Europe, we have, you know, President Trump essentially called out NATO, NATO members for being freeloaders. And in my opinion, the biggest freeloader of the group is Germany, the largest economy, and it doesn't have a military to speak of. And that decision enables Russia. Russia sees that as weakness, and Putin plays on it to do what the hell he wants in the Ukraine, the Crimea. And think of how different NATO would be if France, Germany, and the UK all had robust militaries. I mean, you just look at Putin and say, don't do that. We're not going to allow that. And I'm curious about your thoughts on that. Are we having to relearn this age-old lesson, is that peace is only guaranteed through strength?
I think that's always going to be the case, Mac, because it gets down to the human nature. And, you know, I'd love to think that our better angels would lead us to follow the adage of the great American philosopher Rodney King, who said, why can't we all just get along? But, you know, we can't just all get along, and nations have interests that are, as we well know, are in conflict with one another, and the way to resolve those conflicts in the minds of some is through either direct warfare or insidious warfare, or unconditional warfare, asymmetrical, whatever you want to call it. But and the only way I believe to thwart that is to have standing by or an image of a force that is going to be capable and willing to be used in order to protect that nation's vital interests, which oftentimes expand over into the vital interests of allies, friends, and so forth. But you're right. I don't believe that can be done from a position of weakness. There's got to be the perception that the United States and we are the lone superpower, and with that comes the authority or the responsibility of maintaining that, but being that guardian, if you will, of first of all our own national interests, which have to be first and foremost, but then those of our friends, allies, and maintaining the again the capability and the willingness to use force, and not in a knee jerk reaction way. In the course that I teach, I keep reaffirming the elements of national power, of diplomacy, information, the military, and economics, but to always try to make sure that the military does not become the default position, that's not the first choice, that the first choice is going to be diplomacy and information and economics, and only as a last resort that we start sacrificing life and limb of our precious youngsters.
I want to ask you about that. It looks like we've evolved our advise and assist, support advise and assist missions in Mosul with a sensitivity towards Marshall's admonishment of 7 years. The United States public is no longer in a mood to accept large casualties. I wouldn't even say large. Even moderate to medium level casualties become a national discussion. We seem to, and I think it's a combination of things. I'd be curious about your thoughts. It seems like with some maturation of the Iraqi military, the militias, the Shiite militias, some of them that fought in Mosul, American supporting arms and advising, but not frontline activity, has become somewhat of a blueprint for the way ahead in Iraq, Syria, in northern Syria and eastern Syria, and also seems to be the role of in Task Force Southwest that went back into Helmand. None of those Marines raided combat action ribbon. So it seems like we're beginning to understand that we can, with more mature forces both in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that we've found a way to sustain them, to support them, and to make them successful. Your thoughts on that? Have we evolved the way we do business relative to advising, assisting, and supporting?
Yeah, I think so. And what we're seeing, and again, with some great advisors that President Trump has, primarily in the form of General Mattis, that there has to be a realization that, and I think that there's a real dilemma for the president, because his campaign promise was, to end military involvement, we're going to pull troops out of, various places, including Syria. But with that comes the experience of in 2011 when President Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq, giving rise to ISIS and all the problems we've had since then. So I think there's got to be, a balance here. But what is the role of the U.S. forces? I think is the primary thing. And I admit an upfront bias in this regard, Mac, having served as an advisor to the Vietnamese Marines and having served with some really good advisors and to see what they were able to do. I think that's the key is these wars, these conflicts have to be engaged by those who are most deeply affected. And I would put at the front of that list Saudi Arabia. with its wealth, and it has the role as the protector of the two holiest sites in Islam. I mean, they're the kingpin, but they have got to step up and take, and it looks like there might be some indications of that with the new crown prince, and we hope that's the case. But the other Arab countries, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, et cetera, all, you know, have a capability, but have thus far not been willing to expand that capability in their own neighborhood. So, again, to answer your question, I think we should maintain an advisory role. With that advisory role comes the tremendous asset the U.S. has in the form of intelligence, surveillance, supporting arms, et cetera. But as far as direct combat contact, I think that is best done by those who have the most to gain or lose by success or failure in that area. And I think we can aid that by help the contribution of American advisors.
You know, Tom, interesting. Somebody sent me a quote the other day from, I wouldn't even say the name, but somebody that you would recognize that said, you can't really advise unless you have skin in the game, implying that our model, and I say it's also fiscally sensible, too, not to have large numbers of American troops deployed. Because if you're not suffering casualties, if it's not costing a ton of money, you can sustain that, right? And oh, by the way, it being successful as it was in Mosul, in Iraq, I mean, in northern and eastern Syria, this formula has been successful. Do you buy that? If you don't have skin in the game, if you're out there, if you're not out there dying, then you're not making a difference. You can't really be successful at it. Because I don't. I to me, it's nonsensical.
No, I don't buy that at all. I think there's a it gets into what Socrates once said: how many arguments could be deflated to a single paragraph if we simply defined our terms? But I guess my question would be: what is meant skin in the game? If it means that we have to ante up with a significant number of casualties to show that we're really serious. No, that's not the idea. Again, I get back to, I think, of some pretty basic things. What are the national interests of the United States in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Yemen? Algeria is coming up now as well. So there has to be, and unless there is vital national interest that is at stake, then we ought to think long and hard about putting troops in harm's way, the proverbial boots on the ground. But I think we can accomplish what we want through the use of, again, the support that we have that we're very, very good at, but also with the advisors who can assist in that regard. It's not necessary to have large deployments. And heavens knows we're suffering the effects of continued deployments on our military right now that, from what I read, are really becoming worn out by the day-on, stay-on situation that exists.
The all right, so let me I'm curious about your thoughts on Syria. I'm critical of Barack Obama, and he seems like a wonderful human being, but I don't know, I think history will judge him harshly as one of the weakest presidents that we've had. If you look around the world at the situations the United States is confronted with, that has been enabled by, I believe, 8 years of acquiescence to dictatorships. The Chinese in the South China Sea, and now this week in the East China Sea with their one aircraft carrier running up and down the you know, their coast, acting like they're all that in a bag of chips. And then you have the Chinese that have been largely unchecked with them laying claim to what rightly belongs to the Philippines, Vietnam, and Malaysia with their nine-dash line. You see in Syria him getting us out of there, and his failure there exacerbated that problem. And now we have Iran. Over the weekend, their head of their army said, "We will annihilate Israel within 25 years. I'm confident of that." And then the head of Hezbollah crowed about the range of their weapons. and how they can range any target inside Israel now because of the placement of rockets in southern Lebanon and also in Syria. And then we have the situation in Afghanistan. And so weakness in the face of dictatorships, to me, is what it historically has always been. If you're going to do that, then at some point you're going to have to deal with them, and you're probably making the problem worse. I'm curious about your thoughts of the American role, given the way the cards lay in Syria. What is the American role? Is it to leave, as the president wants to? Is it to maintain its spot in northern and eastern Syria, being a land wedge between the Persian Empire being restored, hopefully being a thorn in the side of the Russians, so that and creating a protective zone so that Syrians can come back there, begin to reestablish cities and whatnot, which will be very difficult to have happen in the western part of Syria, given the conflict that will continue there? Is that burr in the saddle and northern Syria, eastern Syria, as good as we can do? And is that a necessary part to keep Iran in check? What do you see the American role? And do you believe, part two of the question is, do you believe a war between Iran and Israel is unavoidable given the state of affairs in Syria today? So that's a big question for you.
Yeah, first of all, in the questions that you asked, those are all spot on. And the fact that you're asking them, I think that most folks who are giving this a thought would ask as well, is disturbing because these are questions that should be answered prior to the time that we have made any kind of commitment to Syria, or in Syria. Now, I'll be the first to admit, from my limited study and the teaching and so forth, it is a complicated situation. I mean, the relationship that we have with the Kurds, and whose side that they're on, and that have been an ally, but their relationship with Turkey, right. And Turkey as a NATO member, cozying up to all people, Russia. At one time, I think I told you, in class, I tried to draw a line, connecting lines, and it ended up looking like spaghetti. Because it is so complicated, but I think we have to determine what do we want, what is our end state desired in Syria? Is it a new regime? That's risky because I think we've learned over history that don't create a vacuum unless you're ready to fill it, or unless you know who or what is going to fill that vacuum.
So Tom, let me ask you, can we even have that discussion? Because we don't have a vote in that, whether there's a new regime. We can do whatever we want in Geneva, but I'll quote Jack Keane, him saying, look, that ship has sailed. Russia's there. Iran is there. There's no way there's going to be any kind of regime change in Syria because – you know, it's a Sunni-dominated, it's a Sunni-dominated population. When we say regime change, if the Sunnis come to power, that means the Iranians are gone and the Russians are right behind them. So, and the Russians, neither the Russians or Iranians will have that. So it's got to be another Alawite in some kind of transition. The only card that the United States and the Western democracies have left to play is the only place that the kind of money required for the reconstruction of Syria can come from is the Western democracies. That's the only card to get Assad out. So I don't even know, are we even in that discussion, the future of Assad anymore?
I don't know, but at one time that was certainly one of the driving forces back. And,
right.
And has there been an official disputation of that? I have not heard it. It seems to be one of those things of, well, this is one of the outcomes that we would find favorable, but without thinking of the unintended consequences of it.
Right.
I think, again, the necessity of getting those countries who have the most to gain or lose by success or failure, success being a Syria that is not a threat, that does not have Iran as one of its major supporters, and Russia as well, that I once again, it has got to fall on the neighboring countries who thus far, for the most part, have been the silence has been deafening, and their support and the coffers have been empty in that regard. They're more than content to let the U.S. Handle that one. Now, granted, Saudi Arabia is involved in Yemen. Again, one of those quagmires that that never should have taken place, but it is a quagmire of theirs, and Saudi Arabia has to step up along with the other Gulf countries. Once upon a time, there's the Gulf Cooperative Council that was to address things like this, but somehow they have kind of drifted away. But that's what I think is the necessity, is that those countries that are most deeply affected by the continuing festering of the Syrian situation have got to be the ones who are, to use your earlier term, have skin in the game, because they really do have literally skin in the game.
All right. But the United States is inextricably bound to this conflict, because if a shooting war, and again, they're dancing around it. You and I both know they're dancing around it right now. The Israelis and the Iranians are dancing every day with ISR assets, with other surveillance assets, with their combat air patrols. They dance every day. And well, the Israelis have a red line that the Iranians can't cross, because the Israelis know that if they get inside their red line, then what the head of Hezbollah says is true. Israel will be in the position that South Korea finds itself in after 70 years, and not even we won't even talk about the nuclear option in North Korea. The conventional death toll from a North Korean-South Korean conflict will be nuclear-esque because of all the tubes and all the rocket launchers and missile launchers that the North Koreans have dug in. Hezbollah is doing the same thing. And Israel, at some point, if they don't do something, is going to be staring that down and that, no, you will bargain with us or else we will annihilate your cities, because now we have that capacity because we built it up over 50 years.
Well, Israel has just recently had some airstrikes on sites in Syria. Looks like Iranian sites. So the temperature is increasing. What that will mean for us, as an ally of Israel, is certainly daunting. But again, the presence of Iran there, and as you pointed out, attempting to make the land bridge, is certainly an area of a deep concern, certainly to Israel, but also again to the Gulf countries. That, and I guess get back to my main point again, where are they in this endeavor? I mean, we're taking it deadly serious. Do they see it the same way?
Let me read you an email. Mac, I'm curious to get General Droughty's comments on checking Iran. The war in Somalia is simply a proxy war instigated by the Iranians to destabilize the Saudis. Everybody who's familiar with the region knows at the base of this is the Iranian-Saudi Arabia Cold War that rears its ugly head. It's the Sunni-Shiite thing. So I'm curious about this check of Iran. They seem to be the fourth pillar in this quadrant of an evil empire. Thoughts on that? That is that it's the Saudis in. I mean, the Saudis are shooting down missiles, right, that have been fired at Riyadh and other cities in Saudi Arabia from Somalia, right? And those missiles come from Iran. They come from Iran. So
yeah.
Your thoughts on Iran's destabilizing influence, and while I'm sympathetic to that, the United States, is it even an option for the United States to disengage and leave Syria and say, okay, look, whatever happens here between the Russians and the Iranians, so be it. And if it bleeds into Iraq, we're not coming here again to unscrew it. We'll do the Pontius Pilate and wash our hands of that too. And Israel, good luck to you as well. I don't see that as anything close to a course of action for a leader of the free world. And it's not in our national interest either to have a stronger Iraq that reconstitutes the Persian Empire.
No, you're right. And I think, as you described, that is not in our national interest. And it's something we cannot ignore, but it doesn't mean that we have to be as engaged as we have here in the past, in Syria. But again, Iran will continue to be a mischief maker, and we'll see where the agreement goes and who holds to what and who agrees to what. But I think there has to be a continued a focus on the events in Syria as proxies for Russia as well as Iran.
Right.
It's interesting. The other day, last week, I guess it was the 13th or 14th, when the 105 strikes were made on Syria.
Right.
The Russians were alerted beforehand, and one of the questions that came up is, why did they not use their vaunted air defense system, the S-400? And the two theories are, one, that it was incapable of handling the incoming missiles, but the other is they didn't want to give away what it's capable of doing.
What I said was, if they didn't light it off, this is my opinion, in terms of evaluating an adversary, they were collecting, they were using their radars and to collect data on us, right? Trajectory,
yep.
Speed, all of that, what they could interrogate, when they could see it, all the rest of that stuff. So I don't think it's good business to dismiss your adversary saying, yeah, it wasn't effective. If they're a relatively formidable adversary, you best assume, for the sake of your own survival, that they were collecting and they're better prepared for it when the time comes that they will exercise that.
Quick aspect of that that's interesting, though, is that part of the consequences that of all countries, Turkey is thinking about purchasing the S-400. Now, I remember Turkey, one of our NATO allies, and the question came up, if the Russians had used it and it turned out to be less than effective, is that going to affect then the purchase of it? And does it remain better to say, well, we just decided to not use it? But again, the derivative effects of decisions of the 105 strikes that evidently were quite successful 13 or 14 April.
Okay,
go ahead.
I want to ask you. I'm going to play an audio, and I know you've got to run, so I'll let you go. But I want you. The final question I want you to ask is what to what end did we shoot those 105 missiles? And I want you to listen to, I'm going to play the commentary of General Jack Keane, and you'll see him on Fox. He, to say the least, he thought it was better than what Barack Obama did in his tenure, but he thought it was a weak response to a second-rate Russian military presence. And so I'm going to play his audio, and then I want you to get your secret decoder ring out. And and General Mattis and General Tumford, two of the smartest guys I've ever been around, and I've had the privilege of being in a small group with them and listening to them talk about solutions to difficult problems. They're two of the smartest men I know, not only at the tactical and operational level, but at the strategic level. They understand how this stuff needs to be linked to broader strategy in the region. And so I want you to link our response to broader strategy in the region, and I'm going to play General Keane's criticism now. And then you can be Harry Potter, and then I'll let you go on your way.
Okay.
I want to bring in Fox News senior strategic analyst General Jack Keane. General, thank you so much for joining us. We heard Heather Nauert, and we also heard from Holly McKay there on the ground to sort of get a reaction of what the mood is there. But first and foremost, I wanted to get your reaction to Heather Nauert and what do you feel after hearing that?
Well, first of all, let's credit the administration for one. Taking action. Yeah, we had a previous administration that failed to, in view of such a horrific thing as the use of chemical weapons. Second, credit the administration for bringing our allies into the strike and representing the entire international community, because this really is an attack on civilization and the international community.
It's like there's a butt coming.
Yeah, there's a big butt coming. But I think that the response is very weak, in my judgment, particularly in view of the fact that this is a follow-up attack by Assad to a strike that we had already delivered a year ago. It should have been decisive. It should have been consequential. As a result of this strike, we still leave them with multiple chemical storage sites and production capabilities. We didn't put a single glove on an airplane or a delivery system or an airfield. And what is happening? Assad made this calculation. He's trying to secure Damascus. He's been fighting for it for months. The Russians have been bombing every single day. They got down to this one place in Ghouta where the rebels were holding out. Russians bombed all the hospitals, bombed them day in, day out, almost 24-hour bombing. They were still holding out. Assad calculates, okay, I'm going to use chemical weapons. He used the chemical weapons. 6 hours later, the rebels surrendered, and they're gone, and Russian police are there. His calculation was, I'm going to use the weapon. I know the United States is going to respond. I suspect there's going to be another modest response, and I'm willing to pay that price.
Okay, devil's advocate will say, you know, we broadcasted our capability, meaning we sort of tested the waters. They see what we're capable of, and we can do more. The United States is willing to do more. It doesn't seem as if it's one and done, meaning even the ambassador, Nikki Haley, will say, we're locked and loaded.
Well, that's inviting, incentivizing another chemical attack. Isn't the purpose of this is to stop these guys from using these weapons? Look, the thing that we're not talking about here is why didn't we take out all of his military capability that he has? Because we're intimidated by a second-rate power who's trying to pretend to be a superpower called the Russians, and they have put their stooges at those military bases, and we're afraid to do harm to them. That's what's not being discussed. That's the so-called collateral damage. And they threaten escalation. This second-rate power, we have a considerable overmatch of them in the Middle East, or any place else for that matter, is threatening escalation, like they did with Obama in Ukraine. And he bought into it. We should not buy into it. We've got people who are advising the president who are far too risk-averse, to be quite frank about it.
When we heard, a reaction, a statement.
All right. Jack Keane was not happy that day, sir. Give me your thoughts on how does a more restrained response make sense, and how is that in America's strategic interest?
I think it makes sense because it, as he started with his introduction of the positive things that this reflected, that is, for I think one of the first times there a coalition. Granted, UK and France, but at least it was not just the U.S. that was taking action that was deemed necessary in order to send, again, a signal to Assad and his supporters, Russia and Iran, that this cannot proceed further, but without crossing the line of, as he would advocate, of an all-out takeout, all the military capability. Now, I think we're really going into a situation where we're asking for Russia and Iran to put up a shut up in supporting Syria. And is that what do we want a war in Syria with Iran and the Soviet Union, or with Russia? And I think we all agree that the answer is no, yet is necessary to have done something with which we did. And again, I'm encouraged by the fact that France and UK were there. I'm encouraged by recent interview of Macron on Fox News on Sunday. I think we have lots of room for a reason for optimism there. He sees things differently from the president, but nevertheless, I think is an outsider from a political standpoint and one that we ought to embrace quickly and effectively. But you know, to follow the adage of okay, they have. Used chemical weapons again are an indication of chemical weapons, and I'm not sure that we had run that one totally to ground. But based upon that, I think we've gone through this before of based upon insufficient information to react, and I think it was called Iraq in 2003. I think we just have to be a little more circumspect, and I'm confident in men like General Mattis and his advice to the president of knowing how far to go before you're going too far.
And then dumping the charcoal in Russia's lap and saying, look, you know that it's not an equal fight between the two of us. Because Keane is right. Russia, you know, again, economy smaller than the size of Canada. You know, he's faking it. It's Putin with his shirt off and the pictures with his rifle and all the rest of that bullshit. Vladimir Putin is a con artist, running a con game in Eastern Europe and running a con game in the Middle East. He can't do that, and he knows it, and we know it. But we don't have the leaders that will pull his pants down in public and say, you know what, not all that. And so did this dump the charcoal in his lap. And look at him and say, look, you know that we know that you know that we know. Don't go down this road. Because the next time, if it gets ratcheted up, you're going to lose all those ships, you'll lose them. All those aircraft, you'll lose those too. And there's nothing you can do about them. And to the Iranians, we'll stand you in that same corner too. And as we're doing that to the Russians, we'll do it to every one of your ships and every one of your oil installations that we care to. And there's nothing you can do about it. So is that what we did? We dumped the charcoal in his lap and in their lap and say, be careful. All right, we're here. We're not going away.
Well, I can only say that thus far, what I've seen on the part of the president has been surprisingly effective. I think when you look at North Korea, what is taking place there, the relationship with China, that restraint, but understanding that it's a restraint, I think has been effective, and we'll see where it goes. But speaking of going, I've got to get going, you know, off to this.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about New Zealand. Tom was in New Zealand with his wife for 3 weeks, so... So next time we'll have you back on. We'll talk about you can give us our tourist segment.
Travelogue of New Zealand, where they love.
With that, he's gone.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. All right. No. I would love to have you back. All right, Tom. Well, first of all, thank you for squeezing us into your day on late notice. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Always a pleasure. God bless you and Semper Fidelis.
Semper Fidelis.
Bye-bye.
That is... That is Brigadier General Tom Droughty, United States Marine Corps, former commanding officer of the 5th Marine Regiment, deputy commanding general, 1st Marine Division during Desert Storm, and a wonderful, wonderful guy. We're going to try to get Montana Man on here in a few minutes, and we're going to talk about a little bit with he and Mike about this transplant of... male sexual organs and what a good deal that it is. Let me read you a couple emails. This is entitled Dip Cover. I had no clue what you were talking about when you said dip cover. I didn't know that there was such a thing. Probably because I know no one who chews, thank God. By the way, interesting medical topic. A person doesn't think about those types of injuries when we think about battlefield injuries. I typically think about losing arms and legs. I'm glad there are physicians out there with the expertise and skills to help these men. You know what? Again, and it's not something that we talk about. I think that a lot of times, we wouldn't talk about it because it's pretty unpleasant stuff. I mean, even for us who kind of get used to unpleasant, there's a spectrum of unpleasant. And if you missed the story that I told, I'll tell it again real quick. The 11 Bravo block in Mars is being cleared. And, IEDs get laid outside of compound entrances. And to counteract that, we have combat metal detectors. Marines enter a compound. They don't use a metal detector. I don't even know the reason to this day why they didn't, whether they didn't have one near, whether somebody told them to get their asses in there, and whatnot. ID gets functioned, leg blown off, and 20-year-old Lance Corporal reaching for his genitals. He can't find them. Yelling at the doc who's working on his leg. Doc, tell me my junk's still there. Doc, hemming and hawing. Marine checks again. He can't feel anything. And he starts screaming, it's gone. You know, it's gone. My junk's gone. And now he looks at his fellow Marines, and they've had this discussion as they've been in country for a while, and they've seen guys get blown up. And, you know, and there's this pact that, hey, if my junk ever gets blown off, right, I'll kill you, you kill me. And, you know, and so, you know, in your ignorance, you say yes to that. So he turns to them and he says, shoot me. You know, you said you would, you know, shoot me. And of course they wouldn't. And, so he's screaming at them. And then he's screaming, give me my rifle. Give me my rifle and I'll kill myself. So if you can imagine, in addition to seeing your good friend, you know, with his leg blown off, now you're dealing with this. And, you know, you just, the medevac, and he's screaming, don't do this to me. You said you would, you know, give me, you know, all that. You know, it's just, good God, you know, make it stop. You know, make it stop. And so, I mean, we don't, I mean, like, as I said, we don't, and then on the backside of that, you know, and in the article, he says it, this veteran who didn't reveal his identity. He says, you know, my friends don't even know, my families know, and a few close friends know what happened to me. Nobody else does. And so he's quoted in the article in the New York Times. And you could find this article if you go to the website on the read board. It's at the top of the list there on the read board. Quote, that injury, I feel like it banished me from a relationship. Like, that's it, you're done. You're by yourself for the rest of your life. I struggled with even viewing myself as a man for a long time. But now, 4 weeks after the surgery, he said, I feel whole again. You know, and so, you know, people talk about the war and its cost and all that. You know, that's a life sentence, or so we thought. And to see, like, those words, him, that imprint, I feel whole again, I don't know that you can, how do you put a price on that? You know, so God bless the researchers and physicians, the nurses and everybody who had anything to do with this, because it is brutal, absolutely brutal, as a 19, 20-year-old young man or young woman, to be impacted for the rest of your life like this. And, So we'll talk about that. I will tell you, the Iranian, the thing in Syria is it's a shit sandwich, honestly. So now do we find ourselves, since we're on the outside looking in, and we have the Turkish thing, we have the Syrian civil war, right? Which rose out of the Arab Awakening in 2011, yada, yada, yada. I think it was 2011. Right? Impacted by the religious thing between the Alawites and the Sunnis, right? Along with the Iranian thing. You have this crisscross of lines there, as Tom said. Looks like a bowl of spaghetti. So what is the best the United States can do? Leave? And wish Israel good luck? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't have a solution. I do think, though, when you I read Ryan Crocker, who's ambassador forever in that part of the country, his thoughts on it. And I think Crocker's a smart guy. I think in some way, shape, or form, that ought to be American policy. The other thing I want to do, probably on Thursday of this week, is I want you to hear Roger Turner talk about advising now in Afghanistan and how it's different. There's a line relative to advising that if you cross and you begin to do it, you create dependency. And he says that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to allow them to run the operations, bring a bigger thud with our supporting arms, and our aviation support, but not do it for them. All right. They're flying their own combat air missions with helicopters. They're going to start flying the Black Hawk this sometime, I believe this summer. Both combat, both medevac missions and also with combat air support missions. So enabling that capability is huge. And so I want to play that for you because it also ties into, less American casualties. You can sustain it because it's cheaper, in terms of the budget, as you reconstitute the American military from all those years of war. So anyway, my thanks to Tom Droughty for coming on. We'll get see if we can get Montana Man and Mr. Potato Head coming up next on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.